About 11 a.m. the next day, Senator Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate, called Graham. "I just got off the phone with Trump," said Durbin, who had joined Graham in the efforts for a compromise on immigration. "He likes what we did. He wants you and me to come down." Graham called the White House to try to set up a meeting. Kelly came to Graham's office to go over details. Kelly, the immigration hardliner, was edgy. He had told the West Wing staff and even some on the Hill that the president didn't understand what DACA was, that he was ignorant of both the policy and the mechanics. The president had deputized Kelly to handle DACA, and he viewed part of that job as making sure Trump didn't do anything or meet with anyone on DACA, like Graham and Durbin, without him there. "The president can't do this on his own," he'd told West Wing colleagues, "because if he does it on his own, he's going to screw it up." "All I'm asking for is a chance to explain to the president," Graham said. Graham's plan was simple, he repeated. Trump would go along with legislation for Dreamers in exchange for funding for the wall. "Let him make up his own mind," Graham said. He was repeating Kelly's mantra on all issues. He wanted the facts presented to the president, who could then decide. So Graham and Durbin showed up at the White House thinking they would meet alone with Trump. Instead, there was a group of anti-immigrant senators, congressmen, and staffers, including Kelly and Stephen Miller. Graham thought it looked like a lynch mob lined up on chairs in the Oval Office. Graham began walking through the plan, which included the money Trump had asked for on border security. "It was not enough," Trump said, condescending. Graham said he was sure they could do more, but this was where they had started. And he mentioned 25,000 visas from mostly African countries. He turned to the visas for places such as Haiti and El Salvador because of earthquakes, famine, and violence. "Haitians," Trump said. "We don't need more Haitians." At that, and the mention of immigrants from African countries, Trump said, "Why are we having all these people from shithole countries come here?" He had just met with the Prime Minister of Norway. Why not more Norwegians or Asians who could help the economy? Durbin was sickened. Graham was floored. "Time out," Graham said, signaling for a halt with his hands. "I don't like where this thing's going." "America is an ideal," he said. "I want merit-based immigration from every corner of the globe, not just Europeans. A lot of us come from shitholes." Trump snapped back to reasonable, but the damage was done. Durbin went public, revealing Trump's comments about shithole countries, and Graham backed Durbin up. 2 days later, Saturday, Trump called Graham, who thought Trump was calling to take his temperature. How mad was he? Trump said he was playing golf at his club in West Palm Beach. "Well, hit him good," Graham said. "I didn't say some of the things that he said I said," Trump said, referring to Durbin. "Yeah, you did," Graham insisted. "Well, some people like what I said." "I'm not one of them," Graham said. "I want to help you. I like playing golf with you, but if that's the price of admission, count me out. Good luck. Hit 'em good." The idea of shithole countries was not a new one for Trump. During the 2016 campaign, Trump had visited Little Haiti in Miami. Former Haitian leaders had come to the microphones and accused the Clintons of corruption and stealing from Haiti. After the event, in private, Trump seemed down. "I really felt for these people. They came from such a shithole." With Bannon out of the White House, Stephen Miller was the driving force behind the White House's hardline DACA policy. Trump often still expressed sympathy for young people in the DACA program, saying, "A lot of times these kids came here through no fault of their own. They're sympathetic." He also pointed out the political appeal of the Dreamers. Miller would inject the hardline. "Look, everybody calls them the kids and the Dreamers, but," he argued, "they weren't kids anymore. Many were 24 or 26 or 27. Miller's position was absolute. In exchange for a compromise on DACA, we want full border wall funding for a decade, not just 1 year, plus an end to chain migration and the diversity lottery that dispersed up to 50,000 green cards per year to immigrants from nations that otherwise had low immigration rates to the U.S. We're not accepting anything less than all three. On January 21st, Graham attacked Miller publicly. As long as Stephen Miller is in charge of negotiating immigration, we are going nowhere. He's been an outlier for years. I've talked to the president. His heart is right on this issue. He's got a good understanding of what will sell, and every time we have a proposal, it is only yanked back by staff members. On Friday morning, February 23, 2018, Trump spoke at the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, the most important conservative audience in the country. Relaxed and brimming with self-confidence, the president spoke for over an hour. At times, he stuck to his prepared text, but he went exuberantly off the glass at points, speaking spontaneously. "You're getting the wall," he said. "Don't worry." Had a couple of these characters in the back say, "Oh, he really doesn't want the wall. He just used that for campaigning." I said, "Can you believe it?" You know, I say every time I hear that, the wall gets 10 feet higher. You know that. Every single time. Okay now, we're going to have the wall. On immigration, he said, "I don't want people that are going to come in and be accepting all the gifts of our country for the next 50 years and contribute nothing. And I want people that love us. I don't want people coming in the way they do now." He then repeated one of his favorite stories, a rhyming poem about a woman who took in a snake. On her way to work one morning down the path along the lake, a tender-hearted woman saw a poor, half-hearted frozen snake. His pretty colored skin had been all frosted with dew. "Poor thing," she cried, "I'll take you in, and I'll take care of you. Take me in, O tender woman, take me in for heaven's sake. Take me in, O tender woman," sighed the vicious snake. She wrapped him up all cozy in a comforter of silk, and laid him by her fireside with some honey and some milk. She hurried home from work that night, and soon as she arrived, she found that the pretty snake she had taken in had been revived. She stroked his pretty skin again, and kissed and held him tight. But instead of saying thank you, that snake gave her a vicious bite. "I saved you," cried the woman, "and you've bitten me, heavens why! You know your bite is poisonous, and now I'm going to die." "Oh, shut up, silly woman," said the reptile with a grin. "You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in." "And that's what we're doing with our country, folks," Trump said. "We're letting people in, and it is going to be a lot of trouble. It is only getting worse." Trump had just approved a 2-year spending bill for $8.6 trillion that had no money, not one red cent, for the wall. Trump's relationship with his Secretary of State was irrevocably fractured. There were months of speculation that Tillerson was about to quit or be fired. He was in Africa when Kelly warned him in March 2018 to cut his trip short. "You may get a tweet," Kelly said. The morning of March 13th, Trump tweeted that CIA Director Mike Pompeo was going to be the next Secretary of State. "Thank you, Rex Tillerson, for his service," was all he said about Tillerson. Trump told reporters on the South Lawn of the White House, "Rex and I have been talking about this for a long time. We disagreed on things. We were not really thinking the same." Really, it was a different mindset, a different thinking. Chapter 40. Trump was continuing to complain to his attorney Dowd that the Mueller investigation was hampering his ability to act as president. He passed on some classified anecdotes that Dowd, who had a security clearance, could pass to Mueller and Quarles, who also had the proper clearances. cautioning Dowd that it was very sensitive, Trump said one had occurred in April when he had personally negotiated the release of a charity worker, Aya Hijazi, 30, a U.S. citizen who had been imprisoned in Cairo for 3 years. Trump relayed his conversation with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who had an abysmal human rights record, including mass detentions, security forces killing protesters, and military trials of civilians. "Dowd, remember who I'm talking to," he said. "This guy's a fucking killer. I'm getting it done. He'll make you sweat on the phone." And right before we make the deal, el-Sisi says, and Trump assumed a deep, gravelly voice, "Donald, I'm worried about this investigation. Are you going to be around? Suppose I need a favor, Donald." It was like a kick in the nuts. "It's awful," Trump said. In November, Kelly called Dowd. "The president said you're going to see Mueller." "Yeah, we're going to see him in a couple hours." "Mattis has told the president that Putin and the Russians are just getting too dangerous and that we're going to have to deal with them. And I want you to convey that to Bob. Bob knows Mattis." Mueller and the Secretary of Defense had both been Marines. Dowd described to Mueller how everything Trump did with Russia was suspect. "Bob, I know you know General Mattis." Mueller had met with Mattis during a visit to Kandahar in January 2002 when he was FBI director. Dowd reported that Mattis was worried about Russia. "And by the way, you want to check it? Pick up the phone and call him. He knows who you are. He knows you're a Marine." Dowd reminded Mueller that he'd said he wouldn't let grass grow under him. "The grass is about a foot high, pal. We keep defending you with the president." Mueller said he was dead serious about finishing the investigation. "Well, I gotta tell you, Bob, I don't know how long I'm going to last. I defend you guys all the time. I stand up for what you're doing. But you know, we got people being interviewed over and over again." With Mueller, Dowd pushed gently. With Quarles, he complained, "Enough is enough." Dowd had other problems. Ty Cobb started giving interviews to the media saying that the investigation would be over by the end of 2017. "I'd be embarrassed if this is still haunting the White House by Thanksgiving," he told Reuters, "and worse, if it's still haunting him by year-end." The media ran stories with Cobb's picture. Dowd now thought Cobb looked like an old Western sheriff with a handlebar mustache out of the Western novel and miniseries Lonesome Dove, and he was astonished. He was the lead lawyer for the president. Was Cobb having separate conversations with Quarles? "No," Cobb insisted. "My wife wants me out of this," he said, "and so I've been trying to nudge it along publicly." "There's interviews scheduled in December," Dowd said, "and frankly, they're all favorable to the president, so we're going to let them go." Kelly asked Dowd, "Where'd you find this fucking friend, Ty?" Cobb had started off on the wrong foot with Kelly, going behind the chief of staff's back to the president to get an office in the West Wing. He told Cobb, "Don't you ever go behind my fucking back again." Dowd assured the president that their strategy of dealing with Mueller was to cooperate and grind them down until we had a 3D picture of what was in their heads. Based on this picture and the cooperation of 37 witnesses and all the documents turned over, he repeated several times, "I don't see a case." Under Article 2 of the Constitution, Dowd explained to him, the president solely ran the executive branch, and all of his actions, particularly pertaining to Comey, were within those powers. "I will never tell you that your instincts are wrong about these guys and what they're up to. We've been treated very nicely. But we treated them very nicely." In December, a story ran in the German financial daily Handelsblatt saying the Mueller investigation had subpoenaed records from Deutsche Bank, the largest in Germany and the primary lender to Trump. The president called Dowd at 7 a.m. He was furious. "I know my relationships with Deutsche Bank," he said. He maintained the bank loved him and always got paid. "I know what I borrowed, when I paid it back. I know every goddamn one. He could recall whom he had dealt with and other details with specificity. I'm telling you, this is bullshit. Dowd pushed Quarles. Hey, Jim, there's no secrets here. This is bullshit. A conference call was scheduled with lawyers from all the relevant law firms. Everyone sounded like they were talking in code. Look, would you please? Dowd said. My guy does not talk in code. Finally, Quarles reported, There's nothing there. We had subpoenas to Deutsche Bank way back in the summertime, but it doesn't involve the president or his finances. At 10 a.m. on December 21st, Dowd went to see Mueller in an attempt to turn the tables. Often the best defense was to go on the offense. All the records have been produced, Dowd said. All the witnesses have been interviewed except one or two. The entire inquiry appears to be the product of a conspiracy by the DNC, Fusion GPS, which did the Steele dossier, and senior FBI intelligence officials to undermine the Trump presidency. The failure to investigate Comey's role precipitating the inquiry is a travesty. Comey's aberrant and dishonorable conduct demands scrutiny. The Justice Department Inspector General was investigating Comey's actions in the Clinton email case. Kicking the can to the IG undermines confidence in your inquiry, Dowd claimed. Mueller did not reply. Mueller and Quarles kept pushing. They wanted to interview the president. On January 8, 2018, Mueller dictated a list of 16 topics they wanted to ask. Nearly all dealt with Flynn, Comey, or Sessions. Dowd advised the president that list was not specific. What I'd like to do is I'd like to push it even further so you have a better picture. You know, 16 topics? You're kind of guessing as to what they're going to ask you. What are you going to do? Trump asked. Well, my idea is we're going to write him a letter answering these. They would present the facts as they saw them, and make legal arguments, especially about the president's Article II powers, and do it like a Supreme Court brief. We've given them everything, Trump insisted. Why wasn't it enough? He added, I don't mind talking to him. Dowd and Jay Sekulow spent the next 2 weeks drafting the letter. Sekulow, a frequent commentator on the Christian Broadcasting Network and Fox News, had represented conservative, religious and anti-abortion groups over a 30-year career. How you coming? Trump eventually asked Dowd. Can I see it? Dowd came to the White House residence on Saturday, January 27, 2018, around 1 p.m. The president gave him a brief tour, including the Lincoln bedroom. You and I fit in this bed, he joked. We could see ourselves in the mirror, Dowd joked back. If you win this case, Trump said, I'll give you the A-tour. Takes hours. In my opinion, this is the most beautiful mansion in the world. There's nothing like it. Trump's son, Barron, came in with a friend. Dad, Barron said, he wants his picture taken with you. Is that all right? Sure. The picture was snapped. Trump and Dowd sat at a table with a view of the Washington and Jefferson memorials. I would like to give you sort of a feel of what testimony could be like, Dowd said. They would do a practice session. And we'll talk about a couple of these subjects, maybe Comey and Flynn, just lightly. You don't have to do anything to prepare, just come in cold. I want you to read our letter. I'm ready to sign it, but I will not sign it until you feel good about it, because it is a major submission. This tells Bob where we are and where we think he is and why you should not, why he doesn't deserve to ask you questions. If the questions seem harmless, don't treat them that way. And I want you thoroughly focused on listening to the words. I'm not a windy examiner. I like the short, sweet questions, and I like to build it. I'm very patient. And I'll give you the standard advice. Just answer the question. Okay? Got it? Yes. When did you first learn that there was a problem with General Flynn? I'm not sure. I think when McGahn had talked to Sally Yates. But John, I'm not sure. Trump said that the acting attorney general had said that Flynn had told the vice president something that wasn't correct. What did you do about it? Trump said he didn't think he had done anything. I think Don took a hold of it. And they worked. Did you call Flynn in? No. Did you talk to Flynn at all? I don't know. There's something in my mind that he and Priebus called me. Well, Mr. President, did you ever ask him if he talked about sanctions with Russian Ambassador Kislyak? No. Are you sure about that, Mr. President? We have some evidence that there may have been such a conversation. Are you sure about that? Dowd was aware that Priebus had given testimony favorable to the president. In one version with Priebus in the room, Flynn had said in front of the president that he had never discussed his Kislyak conversations with the president. Trump wandered off with a long answer that didn't mean much. Look, let's get back to brass tacks, Dowd said. Oh. Did there come a time when you had to let him go? Dowd asked about Flynn. Yeah. Do you remember how that happened? No. I think he had a letter of resignation. I don't mind telling you, I felt very bad for him. He had his shortcomings, but he was a hell of a nice guy, and I admired him. As you know, I love military guys. So that was the recommendation, and that's what I did. Priebus and McGann had recommended that Flynn be fired. Did they ever tell you about an FBI interview? I don't know. I can't remember. Dowd felt that Trump really couldn't remember. As he asked more questions, there was a lot that Trump said he couldn't remember. He found this understandable given the demands of the presidency. So Dowd went back to December 2016, just after the election, and asked more about Flynn. Well, was he making contact with diplomats, etc.? I assume he was. Did he talk to Kislyak? You know, I don't know. I know there were a lot of conversations among the staff. I think I tweeted out some things. On March 31st, Trump had tweeted, "Mike Flynn should ask for immunity in that this is a witch hunt, excuse for big election loss by media and Dems of historic proportion." What was your position on the sanctions Obama approved? Dowd asked. Obama had expelled 35 Russian diplomats, sanctioned several individuals and entities, and closed two Russian compounds in January 2017. Well, my position was it gave me leverage. Oh, Dowd said, because everybody thinks you would be against them, because you wanted good relations with Putin. No, I looked at them as leverage, Trump repeated. Based on the testimony that Dowd had reviewed, this was accurate. Dowd figured he was cruising pretty well. The six-page memo the White House and Dowd had compiled on Flynn had much more information than Trump was now recalling. Dowd had given the day-by-day account of how the White House discovered that Flynn had lied to Mueller and Quarles, who had complimented the memo for its thoroughness. Well, Dowd asked, why did you tell Director Comey that? You kind of asked him to take it easy on Flynn. What was that all about? I never said, Trump said. He made a contemporaneous memorandum of it, Dowd said, reported it to his buddies. I didn't say that, Trump replied. John, I absolutely didn't say that. Well, he says he's a liar, Trump said. He went full tilt on Comey. The guy's a crook. He's a liar. He bounces between the Clinton email thing and making memos and leaking. The president had his critique down pat. He delivered it all, unleashed, nonstop. Dowd tried to interject. No way. Trump went the whole nine yards. Look, Dowd said after the storm had briefly subsided, you can't answer a question that way. That is what they say is off-putting. It's not good, okay? Be polite about it. Well, goddammit! Did he tell you that you weren't under investigation on January 6th? Yes, he did. He just meant on the salacious part, not collusion, right? Dowd asked. That was one theory in Mueller's team. That's bullshit. He never said that to me. Dowd believed him since Comey had corroborated that there had been no investigation on anything at that point. The next 30 minutes were useless. This thing's a goddamn hoax. Trump reprised everything he had tweeted or said before. Dowd could get nowhere. Trump was raging. Dowd worried that if he had been Mueller, that Trump probably would have fired him on the spot. It was almost as if Trump were asking, "Why am I sitting here answering questions? I am the President of the United States." What a mess. Dowd shrugged his shoulders at the waste of time, but he saw the full nightmare. It was quite a sight, seeing the President of the United States fuming like some aggrieved Shakespearean king. Trump finally came down from the ceiling and began to regain his composure. "Mr. President, that's why you can't testify," Dowd said. "I know you believe it. I know you think it. I know you experienced it. But when you're answering questions, when you're a fact witness, you try to provide facts. If you don't know the facts, I'd just prefer you to say, 'Bob, I just don't remember. I got too much going on here,' instead of sort of guessing and making all kinds of wild conclusions." Then, Dowd handed Trump the draft of the letter addressed to Mueller. The subject read, "Request for testimony on alleged obstruction of justice." A raw assertion of presidential power was printed in boldface. He could, if he wished, terminate the inquiry or even exercise his power to pardon if he so desired. Trump read the 22-page letter carefully, pausing to read several paragraphs out loud. He said he loved the letter. "You know, I've got a hell of a case here. I love the way it's organized." He admired the 59 footnotes. "This is just one of the best days I've ever had in this thing," he went on. His capacity to cycle between emotions from low to high was on full display. "It really is beautiful. I guess it's everything I ever thought of and better. Now I get it. I see what you're doing." "Yeah," Dowd said. "Let's push them to the wall. But you don't want me to testify." "No," Dowd replied. "Why don't we exhaust this thing? Maybe if push comes to shove, I'll suggest to Bob, give me the questions. We will answer them. And we'll make a script. You can come over, ask your questions, and he'll read the answers. How can you complain about that when you've trusted us on everything we've given? Plus, the president cannot possibly remember all this. And by the way, he would love to meet you and talk through this thing, but he needs the assistance of a script." "By God, I'll do that," Trump said. "That's great." "Well," Dowd said, "just imagine if you didn't have the script." "I don't know, John. We just went through that. You think I was struggling?" "Yeah, you are. But, Mr. President, I don't blame you. It's not that you're lying or you're bad or anything like that. Given your daily intake, just look what we've done this afternoon." There had been, during their conversation, several interruptions, two short briefings on world problems, and some classified documents for Trump to sign. How could he remember everything? "You know," Dowd continued, "that gets in the way of trying to recollect what happened 6 months ago or 9 months ago." "That's great," Trump said. "I'm with you. I don't really want to testify." The day after the practice session in the White House, Trump called Dowd. "I slept like a rock," Trump said. "I love that letter. Can I have a copy?" "No," Dowd said. Dowd had the president where he wanted him. On Monday, January 29, 2018, Dowd and Sekulow signed the letter. Dowd then arranged to deliver the letter to Quarles on February 1st. It would be just like in the movies, Dowd thought. Quarles was to walk down the street and hop into Dowd's parked car. They exchanged a few pleasantries and asked about each other's kids. "Well, here's your letter," Dowd said. "What's this?" "In response to your 16 topics," Dowd said, "and we kind of make our case. I leave the door open. I'm going to push for some specific questions. Think about it. You want to talk about it? Tell Bob let's get together." Chapter 41. In a meeting in January 2018, Navarro, Ross, Cohn, and Porter gathered in the Oval Office. After months of arguing about tariffs from entrenched positions, debates had become heated and sharp. Cohn, backed by Porter, rehashed the economic arguments and the geopolitical national security arguments. He talked about how tariffs risked roiling the markets and jeopardizing a lot of the stock market gains. He said the tariffs would be, in effect, a tax on American consumers. Tariffs would take away a lot of the good that Trump had done through tax and regulatory reform. "You're the globalist," Trump said. "I don't even care what you think anymore, Gary." Trump shooed him away. Cohn retreated to a couch. Navarro and Porter picked up the debate, with Ross interjecting on Navarro's side from time to time. Navarro argued that tariffs would raise revenues and be beloved by businesses and unions. He said it would be a great way for Trump to get union support and help his base in advance of the 2018 midterm election. Porter brought up the Bush tariffs and the net job loss that had occurred. In the years since, Porter argued, downstream industries that consumed and relied on steel, builders and pipelines and the auto industry, had expanded, while there was little potential for expansion of steel manufacturing and production jobs. The job losses under new tariffs would be even more pronounced than the ones during the Bush administration. Porter said Navarro's belief that tariffs would be met with widespread acclaim was just dead wrong. Many businesses would oppose tariffs because they were buyers and consumers of steel. "The automakers are going to hate this," Porter said. "They have narrow margins, and this is going to raise their costs. Pipeline makers, too. We're opening up all these new federal public lands and offshore drilling. It requires people building pipelines." "And the unions," Porter said. "Well, that's crazy. Sure, the steel union is going to love this, but the United Auto Workers isn't going to like this. The building and construction trades isn't going to like this. It's going to up their costs." Porter ordinarily tried to remain an honest broker who facilitated the discussion. When he had a strong view, he tended to wait until he was one-on-one with the president. Now he was outing himself as a free trader. Navarro countered each argument as strenuously as Porter made it. Chief of Staff John Kelly walked into the room midway through the meeting. The president was watching the back and forth avidly. "What are you, an economist now?" Trump asked Porter after he and Navarro had taken verbal swings at each other for nearly half an hour. "What do you know about economics? You're a lawyer." Porter said he had studied and tutored others in economics while he was at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. He pointed out that many of his arguments weren't strictly economic. "I always knew Gary was a fucking globalist," Trump said. "I didn't know you were such a fucking globalist, Rob." Trump turned to Kelly. "Get a load of this guy. He's a globalist." Kelly nodded and smiled. He wanted this meeting wrapped up. The meeting broke up without a real resolution, except to remind Trump that he had signed a decision memo to move forward on the 301 investigation with China and announced it. That had to come before steel tariffs. That was the strategy and agreement. Porter left the White House on February 7th after two ex-wives went public with allegations that he had physically abused them. One released a photo showing a black eye that she said Porter gave her. Each, one to the press and one in a blog post, gave graphic descriptions of domestic abuse. Porter quickly concluded it would be best for all, his former spouses, his family and close friends, the White House and himself, to resign. He wanted to focus on repairing relationships and healing. The New York Times wrote, "Abuse claims and stars rise in White House," and "AIDS clean-cut image belied his hot temper," former colleagues say. In a statement, Porter said, "I took the photos given to the media nearly 15 years ago, and the reality behind them is nowhere close to what is being described. People's lives are being shattered and destroyed by a mere allegation," Trump tweeted. The Washington Post editorial board accused the White House of shrugging off domestic violence. And the New York Times said, Trump appears to doubt the hashtag MeToo movement. Cohn saw that one of the main restraining influences on Trump was now gone. After 6:30 on the night of Wednesday, February 28th, Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and Peter Navarro went to the Oval Office and convinced the president to move ahead with steel tariffs before the 301 investigation was complete, imploding the whole trade strategy. Ross had earlier produced a study maintaining that the rising imports of steel and aluminum were a threat to the national security, giving Trump the authority to impose them without Congress. Ross and Navarro had arranged for the main U.S. steel executives to come to the White House the next day. When Cohn got word of the plan, he called Kelly around 10 p.m. I don't know anything about a meeting, Kelly said. There's no meeting. Oh, there's a meeting. What are you talking about, Gary? Cohn tried to kill the meeting, and for a while he thought he had succeeded. But then it was back on. More than a dozen executives showed up the next day. At a meeting in the cabinet room, Trump announced that he had decided to impose a 25% tariff on foreign-made steel and 10% on aluminum. You will have protection for the first time in a long while, Trump told the executives. And you're going to regrow your industries, he said, even though all the data Cohn had gathered showed it was not practical or even possible. Cohn believed if they had completed the work on the intellectual property case against China, they would have had the allies on board for a blockbuster trade case. It would have been most of the world against China. Their economic rival would be isolated. Steel tariffs upended all of that. Cohn concluded that Trump just loved to pit people against each other. The president had never been in a business where he had to do long-term strategic thinking. He went to see Trump to explain that he was resigning. If this is the way you're going to run the place, Cohn said, he was going to leave. I can deal with losing a battle in the White House as long as we follow proper protocol and procedure. But when two guys get to walk in your office at 6:30 at night and schedule a meeting that the chief of staff and no one knows about, I can't work in that environment. Cohn knew the importance of Hope Hicks, who had been elevated to White House Communications Director. Cohn often asked her to join him when he was heading into a tough conversation with Trump, saying, Hope, come on in with me. He found Hicks softened the president and that Trump treated Cohn differently when she was there. On Tuesday, March 6th, he went to see Hicks. They crafted a statement for the president to issue with Cohn's resignation. Gary has been my chief economic advisor and did a superb job in driving our agenda, helping to deliver historic tax cuts and reforms, and unleashing the American economy once again. He is a rare talent, and I thank him for his dedicated service to the American people. They fiddled with the language, then took a printed copy into the Oval Office. They took seats at the Resolute desk. Mr. President, Cohn said, today's probably the right day for me to put out my resignation. Gary's been so great, Hicks said, soothing the moment. We're going to miss him so much. This is a shame. We've got to find a way to bring him back. Of course, the president said. We're going to bring him back. It was a false show to the end. Cohn realized again what he had said before to others about the president. He's a professional liar. I've got a quote here that I've okayed with Gary, Hicks said. I want you to okay it. Trump took the piece of paper and tweaked a word, but otherwise let the statement stand. It's a huge loss, Trump said, but we'll be fine, and he's coming back. Gary Cohn to resign as Trump advisor after dispute over tariffs, Bloomberg reported. Gary Cohn resigns amid differences with Trump on trade, said the Washington Post. Gary Cohn resigns apparently over tariffs, read the Atlantic. Gary Cohn resigns as White House economic advisor after losing tariffs fight, said the Wall Street Journal. Later, after he resigned, Cohn worried about instability in the economy that would come from tariffs and the impact on the consumer. The U.S. is a consumer-driven economy, and if the consumer is unsure of what the economy will look like and what their disposable income will look like, that will be seen very quickly in the economy and in the stock market. Trump's action and mounting threats on tariffs were jarring. Cohn thought that Trump had to know. But he's not man enough to admit it. He's never been wrong yet. He's 71. He's not going to admit he's wrong, ever. Tom Bossert, the president's advisor for Homeland Security, Cybersecurity, and Counterterrorism, went to the Oval Office in the spring of 2018 and found Trump in his private dining room. "Sir, do you have a minute?" Bossert, a 43-year-old lawyer and security expert, asked. "I want to watch the Masters," Trump said. He had TiVo'd the Augusta National Golf Club tournament, the most famous in the world, and was glued to it. Bossert, another high-flying aide with Oval Office access, even in the Kelly era, invited himself to sit down and watch. The lawyer knew the United States was already in a constant state of low-intensity cyber war with advanced foreign adversaries such as China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. These countries had the ability to shut down the power grid in the United States cities, for example, and the only deterrent was to make clear that a massive cyber attack would not just be met with cyber for cyber symmetry. The full force of the U.S. military, including nuclear weapons, would have to be a central part of the deterrent. Bossert liked to say, and he said it regularly, that the use of any element of national power would be justified. The United States had too much to lose in a high-consequence cyber attack. Bossert had repeated it so often that the president seemed to understand, but the import of this, nuclear weapons as a cyber deterrent, had not quite become part of the public debate. "What's going on?" Trump finally asked. "I'm coming at you one more time," Bossert said. "I'm going to do TV, the upcoming ABC Sunday show this week. But this China trade issue is going to come up again. So would cyber." "You and your cyber," Trump said, "are going to get me in a war with all your cyber shit." "That's the point, sir. I'm trying to use other elements of national power to prevent bad behavior online. And that's going to put me right in the middle of all of the decisions you're making. That's why I'm here. You're now in the middle of a personal negotiation with President Xi. You just upped the ante to $150 billion in tariff threats with China." "Fine. How do you want me to handle it on TV? I don't want to go out and say something that's going to then piss you off." Trump jumped at the invitation to provide some television coaching, to mainline some performance wisdom. It was pure delight. "So here's how you do it," Trump said, his fingers flying in the air. "Tom, are you ready? You go up there, you say..." He wanted to formulate it just right. "You tell them you've never seen..." No, wait. "First you tell them, Trump's dead serious. That's what you tell them. Are you ready?" Trump's hands and fingers went up again. "You tell them $150 billion. Wait, you tell them $150 billion is nothing. He's ready to go to $500 billion because he's tired of not being treated fairly. That's what you tell them." Trump continued with animated fingers. "You ready? That's what you tell them." "Okay," Bossert said. "You want me to go hard?" "You go hard," Trump said with enthusiasm. "If it weren't for Sunday, you'd shut the markets down. That's how fucking hard you fucking go." Fingers up again. "Hold on, wait. Then you say, don't worry about it. See here, watch. Here's what you do." Trump offered some stage direction, one hand up again for dramatic emphasis. "Then you say, it'll be all right because the relationship Trump has with Xi is so..." A pause. A refinement. "It's the best. Wait. You've never seen such a good relationship between two presidents in your life. Maybe ever." Are you ready? The president asked. Bossert thought he would remember the script and the Trump show, perhaps for the rest of his life. It was Trump's way of saying, go hard. Trump's willing to go to the mat. We're being treated unfairly. And don't worry about soybeans, Trump said. The Chinese had announced they would retaliate with tariffs on American agriculture and other goods. Speaking in the third person, Trump said, he'll buy more goddamn soybeans if Trump has to. He'll buy his own damn soybeans from his own farmers before the Chinese push him around. But then you tell them, it'll be all right. He and Xi will work out a deal. It'll be a beautiful deal, the best deal you've ever seen. So you want me to go hard and soft? Bossert now asked, hard on determination and soft on the relationship with Xi. Yeah. Bossert raised cyber again. Oh, for Christ's sake, Trump said. If you have to hit the cyber thing, fine. Bossert saw that Trump wanted him to stick to trade. Boss, here's how I do it. It's a trade dispute, it's not a trade war. There's a trade deficit. In the 80s, we had a trade dispute with Japan, and we were close allies with them at the same time. Perfect, Trump said. You got it. You throw that crap in there, sounds good, then you tell them what I said, and then you're good. Apparently, trying to tamp down any anxiety, he added, Tom, you'll be fine. Afterward, Bossert stuck his head in Kelly's office just as a courtesy to say he had just been prepping for TV with the president and had nothing unusual to report. Kelly waved him off. It seemed to Bossert that the chief of staff was greatly diminished, resigned, and had largely given up. Bossert was ready with his talking points, but on ABC, host Martha Raddatz focused on border security. Trump had said he wanted to send 2,000 to 4,000 National Guard troops to the southern border. It was the topic of the day, driven by Trump's comment. She never asked about China. Bossert was disappointed because he was ready to pass along the president's message of determination and the extraordinary bonding with President Xi of China. Chapter 42. The rest of February, Dowd didn't hear much. He thought Mueller and Quarles were slow rolling it. A meeting was finally arranged for 2 p.m. on Monday, March 5th at Mueller's office. Mueller was accompanied by Quarles and three other prosecutors. Dowd came with Sekulow and another lawyer. It quickly became clear that they had different views about the purpose of the meeting. Well, Mueller said, I guess that's it. What are you talking about? Dowd asked. Where are the questions? You know, I don't know, Mueller said, a poker player in mid-game. Jim said that's what was going to happen here. Well, you know, I don't know, Mueller said again. Seems to me you're not going to testify. Under the circumstances, exactly right. Well, you know, Mueller said, I could always get a grand jury subpoena. You go right the fuck ahead and get it, Dowd said, striking the table with his hand. I can't wait to file a fucking motion to quash. And I want to hear you tell the U.S. District Judge what the crime is, and I want you to explain. Dowd said Mueller had all the evidence he could possibly need. My motion to quash is going to have everything we've given you, including the testimony of 37 witnesses, including the 1,400,000 documents with the highlights on the most intimate conversations of the president. I want you to tell that judge why you need a grand jury subpoena, which, by the way, has never been issued in the history of the country to any president. And, by the way, there is no president, all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, who's ever been so transparent. Dowd continued, You want to go to war? Let's go to war. And by the way, I will tell the president that you have now threatened us with a grand jury subpoena. So, Mr. President, if you don't testify, I'm going to haul your ass in front of the public and we're going to have a grand jury subpoena. We're going to have a hearing. And by the way, Bob, none of this evidence is before the grand jury. So I want you to explain that to the federal judge why none of this is before his or her grand jury yet. Dowd believed all the main evidence was in the interviews and documents, and only in rare cases had that sort of evidence been presented to the grand jury. "John, it's okay," Mueller said, trying to calm Dowd. "Bob, you threatened the President of the United States with a grand jury subpoena when he's not a target, and barely a subject. He's essentially a goddamn witness, and I'm going to tell the judge that. So he has no criminal liability as of March 5th, 2018, the date they were meeting. Nothing. And I'm going to tell the judge I'm not going to let you play gotcha. I'm not going to have you start testing the recollection of this president over something that there is no crime. And Bob, I've asked you. You're the one that wanted to engage. Talk about reciprocity. You guys tell me where the collusion is, and don't give me that chicken shit meeting in June," Dowd said, referring to Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with a Russian lawyer in Trump Tower. "That's nothing. There's no collusion. And the obstruction? It's a joke. Obstruction's a joke. Flynn? I mean, Yates and Comey didn't think he lied. And by the way, he told, in the memo of the White House counsel, he told them the agents had said they closed his file. I mean, Flynn believed that he had no jeopardy. Yeah, none." Dowd continued, "I can't wait to read your papers. Well, my papers are going first. And by the way, just give me the subpoena. I'll take it." "John," Mueller said, "I'm not trying to threaten you. I'm just thinking of the possibilities here." Dowd pivoted to the good old boy approach. "The other possibility is, give me the questions. We have a relationship of mutual trust. We've trusted you guys. You've trusted us. And we've never failed you. Bob, isn't really the important thing that you get whatever the truth is? And you've got us working for you." Dowd decided to take an extraordinary step. "I have no secrets with you guys," Dowd said. "I'm going to tell you about my conversation with the President of the United States on the subject of testimony." He mentioned three of the questions he had taken Trump through up in the White House residence. On the third, he had no clue. He just made something up. That's his nature. Dowd realized he had Mueller's full attention. "Jay," he said to Sekulow, "you play the president, I'll play Mueller, okay?" They would role-play what Dowd had witnessed with the president. "Let's talk about Comey." Dowd asked about one of Trump's Comey conversations. Sekulow's answer was classic Trump, an answer spun out of thin air with contradictions, made-up stuff, anger. A perfect performance. A perfect Trump. "Gotcha. Gotcha. 1001. Dowd said, slamming the table, referring to the section of the U.S. Code that deals with false statements. "Gotcha! 1001. Dowd asked another simple question of Sekulow, still playing Trump. "I don't know," Sekulow said. "I don't know. I don't know." "Jay," Dowd said, "how many times did he say, 'I don't know,' when we talked to him?" "Oh, a dozen? 20? "Bob," Dowd said to Mueller, "here's my point. You're asking me to sit next to a president who'll get to the third question, screw it up, and thereafter, because I'm going to counsel him, he just doesn't know and he doesn't remember. So he's going to say, 'I don't remember,' 20 times. And I'm telling you, Bob, he doesn't remember. And by the way, if you'd like, I will get General Kelly in here to tell you he doesn't remember. And the reason he doesn't remember is very simple. One, these facts and these events are of little moment in his life. Most had taken place early in his presidency. All of a sudden, he's the boss. But he's getting information from all quarters, including the media, every day. That is like tonnage. And the fact is, I don't want him looking like an idiot. And I'm not going to sit there and let him look like an idiot, and you publish that transcript because everything leaks in Washington, and the guys overseas are going to say, 'I told you he was an idiot. I told you he was a goddamn dumbbell. What are we dealing with that idiot for? He can't even remember XYZ with respect to his FBI director.'" Dowd was aware that he had illustrated the president was clearly disabled. "John, I understand," Mueller said. "Well, Bob, what do you want to know? Give me one question that no one has answered." Well, I want to know if he had corrupt intent. Bob, do you think he's going to say yes? Because on his behalf, I'm telling you no. And if you want me to get an affidavit from the president that he had no corrupt intent, I'll give it to you. Let me think about it, Mueller said. I hate to think that you would be playing us. Wait a minute, Dowd said. Give me a fucking break. I've got a track record here that is unimpeachable. You ask Jim Quarles if I've ever played him. Is there anything that I've ever said to you that wasn't correct? No, Quarles answered. John's one of the best lawyers we deal with. Dowd began to think that Mueller didn't know the facts of the case. Under the joint defense agreement with some 37 witnesses, Dowd had received debriefings from the lawyers for them. Did anyone lie? Dowd asked. No, Mueller said. Did anyone destroy documents? No, Mueller said. Am I right that you want good, reliable answers? Yes. Get me the questions, Dowd said, and I will take them and tell you whether we can answer them. He would provide the answers, a line or two to each question. Fair swap, he continued. You give me the questions, so I know what's on your mind. General Kelly could get Mueller, his team, and a court reporter into the White House without anyone knowing. We'll have a script. The president would be under oath. We'll get it just the way we want it, but we're telling you that's the truth as we know it. The president's saying that's the truth as he knows it with the assistance of counsel. So either that, or you sit there while we interrupt him for 6 hours, or he plays, I don't know. Mueller's team were shaking their heads and made it clear that had never been done before. No way. It was unheard of. Let me think about whether to give you some questions, Mueller said. Dowd reminded Mueller that in July or August, when Trump had attacked Mueller and Sessions, Mueller had contacted Dowd to say, I got a problem. Can you come by? You said I got people refusing to testify that don't need to refuse to testify. They don't have any culpability at all. But I'm afraid that the atmosphere, they feel like they're disloyal if they testify. And Dowd had told him, well, I'll go public and say we want everyone to cooperate. The president's cooperating. We're cooperating 100%, and we encourage everyone to do that. Dowd and Cobb had been quoted in the press saying Trump and the White House would continue to fully cooperate. As he had at each meeting, Dowd said, what's at stake is the country. The president needed to do his job and did not have time for this investigation. There were serious, even dramatic tensions in the world. North Korea, Iran, the Middle East, Russia, China. I'm very sensitive to that, Mueller replied. I'm doing the best I can. Why don't you just give us the questions? Dowd pressed. Mueller didn't like it. Dowd knew he was gambling and daring Mueller by threatening to fight a grand jury subpoena. That was his design, sending a message that if Mueller wanted to go the grand jury route, this was what it would look like. He would fill his motions with exhibits, and the district judge would spend 2 weeks reading them. Dowd had laid it out as strongly as he could to Mueller. And you're going to have to stand in the well of the court and tell the judge why you want to put the President of the United States in the grand jury. Bob, as you know, I've handled cases like this, and I wouldn't go near the grand jury with the President of the United States. He had a final argument. The perjury trap was what Mueller's team did, he charged. You did it to Flynn, you did it to Gates, you did it to George Papadopoulos, a former campaign aide. You guys, that's the games you played. Rick Gates, a Manafort business associate and Trump's deputy campaign chairman, had one of the best lawyers sitting next to him and had still lied. You guys gave him no time to prepare, and now he's got a felony. Bob, that's exactly what I told the president. That's what they're going to do to you in an interview. Dowd thought it possible, even likely, that there was something he didn't know. Bob, you guys are all wound up about something. There must be something here. Maybe you disapprove of the president's behavior. but you don't have a case. Whatever they had, Dowd said,